Chapter 43. Talked and laughed with Hammond Brake gaily, as if nothing was on my mind, while all the time a great load of suspicion lay heavily at my heart. At length Hammond Brake rose to go. I wished him good night, but did not offer to accompany him to the door. My wife supplied this omitted courtesy, as I had expected. The moment I was alone, I picked up the book leaf from the floor. It was not the leaf of a volume of poems. Beyond that, however, I learned nothing. It contained a string of paragraphs printed in the biblical fashion, and the language was biblical in style. It seemed to be a portion of some religious book. Was it possible that my wife was being converted to the Romish faith? Yes, that was it. Brake was a Jesuit in disguise. I had heard of such things, and had stolen into the bosom of my family, to plant there his destructive errors. There could be no longer any doubt of it. This was some portion of a Romish book, some infamous popish publication. Fool that I was not to see it all before. But there was yet time. I would forbid him the house. I had just formed this resolution when my wife entered. I put the strange leaf in my pocket, and took my hat. "Why, you are not going out, surely?" cried Elsie, surprised. "I have a headache," I answered. "We'll take a short walk." Elsie looked at me with a peculiar air of distrust. Her woman's instinct told her that there was something wrong. Before she could question me, however, I had left the room, and was walking rapidly on Hammond Brake's track. He heard the footsteps, and I saw his figure, black against the sky, stop and peer back through the dusk, to see who was following him. "It is I, Brake," I called out. "Top, I wish to speak with you." He stopped, and in a minute or so we were walking side by side along the road. My fingers itched at that moment to be on his throat. I commenced the conversation. "Brake," I said, "I'm a very plain sort of man, and I never say anything without good reason. What I came after you to tell you is that I don't wish you to come to my house anymore, or to speak with Elsie any farther than the ordinary salutations go. It's no joke. I'm quite in earnest." Brake started, and, stopping short, faced me suddenly in the road. "What have I done?" he asked. "You surely are too sensible a man to be jealous, Dayton." "Oh," I answered scornfully, "not jealous in the ordinary sense of the word, a bit. But I don't think your company good company for my wife, Brake. If you will have it out of me, I suspect you of being a Roman Catholic, and of trying to convert my wife." A smile shot across his face, and I saw his sharp white teeth gleam for an instant in the dusk. "Well, what if I am a papist?" he said, with a strange tone of triumph in his voice. "He faith is not criminal. Besides, what proof have you that I was attempting to proselyte your wife?" "This," said I, pulling the leaf from my pocket, "is leaf from one of those devilish papist books you and she were reading this evening. I picked it up from the floor. Proof enough, I think." In an instant, Brake had snatched the leaf from my hand, and torn it into atoms. "You shall be obeyed," he said. "We'll not speak with Elsie, as long as she is your wife. Good night." "You think I'm a papist, then, Dayton? You're a clever fellow." And with rather a sneering chuckle, he marched on along the road, and vanished into the darkness. 2. The secret discovered, Brake came no more. I said nothing to Elsie about his prohibition, and his name was never mentioned. It seemed strange to me that she should not speak of his absence, and I was very much puzzled by her silence. Her moodiness seemed to have increased, and, what was most remarkable, in proportion as she grew more and more reserved, the intenser were the bursts of affection which she exhibited for me. She would strain me to her bosom and kiss me, as if she and I were about to be parted forever. Then for hours she would remain sitting at her window, silently gazing, with that terrible, wistful gaze of hers, at the west. I will confess to having watched my wife at this time. I could not help it. That some mystery hung about her, I felt convinced. I must fathom it or die. Her honor I never for a moment doubted. Yet there seemed to weigh continually upon me the prophecy of some awful domestic calamity. This time the prophecy was not in vain. About 3 weeks after I had forbidden break my house, I was strolling over my farm in the evening apparently inspecting my agriculture, but in reality speculating on that topic which latterly was ever present to me. There was a little knoll covered with evergreen oaks at the end of the lawn. It was a picturesque spot, for on one side the bank went off into a sheer precipice of about 80 feet in depth, at the bottom of which a pretty pool lay, that in the summer time was fringed with white water lilies. I had thought of building a summer house in this spot, and now my steps mechanically directed themselves toward the place. As I approached, I heard voices. I stopped and listened eagerly. A few seconds enabled me to ascertain that Hammond Brake and my wife were in the copse talking together. She still followed him then, and he, scoundrel that he was, had broken his promise. A fury seemed to fill my veins as I made this discovery. I felt the impulse strong upon me to rush into the grove, and then and there strangle the villain who was poisoning my peace. But with a powerful effort I restrained myself. It was necessary that I should overhear what was said. I threw myself flat on the grass, and so glided silently into the copse until I was completely within earshot. This was what I heard. My wife was sobbing. "Oh, soon, so soon? I Hammond, give me a little time. I cannot, Elsie. My chief orders me to join him. You must prepare to accompany me." "No, no," murmured Elsie. "He loves me so. And I love him. Our child, too, how can I rob him of our unborn babe?" "Another sheep for our flock," answered Brake solemnly. "Sigh, do you forget your oath? Are you one of us, or are you a common hypocrite, who will be of us until the hour of self-sacrifice, and then fly like a coward? Elsie, you must leave tonight." "Ah, my husband, my husband," sobbed the unhappy woman. "You have no husband, woman," cried Brake harshly. "Promised Dayton not to speak to you, as long as you were his wife, but the vow was annulled before it was made. Your husband in God yet awaits you. You will yet be blessed with a true spouse." "I feel as if I were going to die," cried Elsie. "How can I ever forsake him, he who was so good to me?" "Nonsense. No weakness. He is not worthy of you. Go home and prepare for your journey. You know where to meet me. I will have everything ready, and by daybreak there shall be no trace of us left. Beware of permitting your husband to suspect anything. He is not very shrewd at such things. He thought I was a Jesuit in disguise, but we had better be careful. Now go. You have been too long here already. Bless you, sister." A few faint sobs, a rustling of leaves, and I knew that Brake was alone. I rose, and stepped silently into the open space in which he stood. His back was toward me. His arms were lifted high over his head with an exultant gesture, and I could see his profile, as it slightly turned toward me, illuminated with a smile of scornful triumph. I put my hand suddenly on his throat from behind, and flung him on the ground, before he could utter a cry. "Not a word," I said, unclasping a short-bladed knife which I carried. "Answer my questions, or, by heaven, I will cut your throat from ear to ear." He looked up into my face with an unflinching eye, and set his lips, as if resolved to suffer all. "What are you? Who are you? What object have you in the seduction of my wife?" He smiled, but was silent. "Ah, you won't answer. We'll see." I pressed the knife slowly against his throat. His face contracted spasmodically, but although a thin red thread of blood sprang out along the edge of the blade, Brake remained mute. An idea suddenly seized me. This sort of death had no terrors for him. I would try another. There was the precipice. I was twice as powerful as he was, so I seized him in my arms, and in a moment transported him to the margin of the steep smooth cliff, the edge of which was garnished with the tough stems of the wild vine. He seemed to feel it was useless to struggle with me, so allowed me passively to roll him over the edge. When he was suspended in the air, I gave him a vine stem to cling to, and let him go. He swung at a height of 80 feet, with face upturned and pale. He dared not look down. I seated myself on the edge of the cliff, and with my knife, began to cut into the thick vine a foot or two above the place of his grasp. I was correct in my calculation. This terror was too much for him. As he saw the notch in the vine getting deeper and deeper, his determination gave way. "I'll answer you," he gasped out, gazing at me with starting eyeballs. "What do you ask?" "What are you?" was my question, as I ceased cutting at the stem. "A Mormon," was the answer, uttered with a groan. "Ache me up. My hands are slipping. Quick." "And you wanted my wife to follow you to that infernal Salt Lake City, I suppose?" "For God's sake, release me. I'll quit the place, never to come back. Do help me up, Dayton, I'm falling." I felt mightily inclined to let the villain drop, but it did not suit my purpose to be hung for murder, so I swung him back again on the sword, where he fell panting and exhausted. "Will you quit the place tonight?" I said. "Who'd better? By heaven, if you don't, I'll tell all the men in the village, and we'll lynch you, as sure as your name is Brake." I'll go," he groaned. "Swear never to trouble you again. You ought to be hanged, you villain. Be off." He slunk away through the trees like a beaten dog, and I went home in a state bordering on despair. I found Elsie crying. She was sitting by the window as of old. I knew now why she gazed so constantly at the west. It was her Mecca. Something in my face, I suppose, told her that I was laboring under great excitement. She rose startled as soon as I entered the room. "Elsie," said I am come to take you home." "Home? Why, I am at home, am I not? What do you mean?" "No. This is no longer your home. You have deceived me. You are a Mormon. I know all. You have become a convert to that apostle of hell, Brigham Young, and you cannot live with me. I love you still, Elsie, dearly, but you must go and live with your father." Nathaniel Hawthorne, The Minister's Black Veil, A Parable 1. 1. Another clergyman in New England, Mr. Joseph Moody, of York, Maine, made himself remarkable by the same eccentricity that is here related of the Reverend Mr. Hooper. In his case, however, the symbol had a different import. In early life he had accidentally killed a beloved friend, and from that day till the hour of his own death, he hid his face from men. The sexton stood in the porch of Milford Meeting House, pulling busily at the bell rope. The old people of the village came stooping along the street. Children, with bright faces, tripped merrily beside their parents, or mimicked a graver gait in the conscious dignity of their Sunday clothes. Spruce bachelors looked sidelong at the pretty maidens, and fancied that the Sabbath sunshine made them prettier than on weekdays. When the throng had mostly streamed into the porch, the sexton began to toll the bell, keeping his eye on the Reverend Mr. Hooper's door. The first glimpse of the clergyman's figure was the signal for the bell to cease its summons. "But what has good Parson Hooper got upon his face?" cried the sexton in astonishment. All within hearing immediately turned about, and beheld the semblance of Mr. Hooper, pacing slowly his meditative way towards the meeting house. With one accord they started, expressing more wonder than if some strange minister were coming to dust the cushions of Mr. Hooper's pulpit. "Are you sure it is our parson?" inquired Goodman Gray of the sexton. "Of a certainty it is good Mr. Hooper," replied the sexton. "He was to have exchanged pulpits with Parson Chute, of Westbury, but Parson Chute sent to excuse himself yesterday, being to preach a funeral sermon. The cause of so much amazement may appear sufficiently slight. Mr. Hooper, a gentlemanly person, of about 30, though still a bachelor, was dressed with due clerical neatness, as if a careful wife had starched his band, and brushed the weekly dust from his Sunday's garb. There was but one thing remarkable in his appearance. Swathed about his forehead, and hanging down over his face, so low as to be shaken by his breath, Mr. Hooper had on the black veil. On a nearer view it seemed to consist of two folds of crepe, which entirely concealed his features, except the mouth and chin, but probably did not intercept his sight, further than to give a darkened aspect to all living and inanimate things. With this gloomy shade before him, good Mr. Hooper walked onward, at a slow and quiet pace, stooping somewhat, and looking on the ground, as is customary with abstracted men, yet nodding kindly to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.